From heroic dogs to a hero for ducks, a regular guy who rescued a nest full of ducklings from certain death. You see, Joel Armstrong worked at an ordinary bank in downtown Spokane, Washington. Sitting in his office back in May, he noticed an unusual scene, a duck in the awning just outside his second-story window.
I kind of looked and realized that she had built a nest, and then I noticed some eggs in there.
Armstrong watched and waited until one day those eggs hatched, 10 yellow puffs with beaks. The next day, Armstrong saw the mother duck pacing along the high awning, 10 ducks following her every move.
All of a sudden, the mother jumped down to the sidewalk. At that moment, I just said, I've got to get down there and help these things. I think they're going to start jumping.
The first duckling waddled up to the ledge and jumped. It was 10 feet down to the sidewalk. The little duck lay limp. That's when Joel Armstrong leaped into action.
So I ran over there, stood under the awning. Another friend stood 40, 50 feet away and told me when they were about to jump. And then I'd look up and catch them and then just instantly kind of drop them to the ground. And the mother didn't really seem to care.
Our duck hero jumped out and caught every single duckling. And the first one he'd seen hit the sidewalk, it sprang back to life. The next danger was traffic. It was a three-block waddle to the Spokane River, so Armstrong grabbed a cardboard box, collected the ducklings, and walked them down the street. He carried the box low so Mama Duck could see her babies. Finally, they reached the river.
The mom ran over there. Her ducklings just followed, and then she plopped in the river, and they knew how to swim instantly, and they were so happy. And the mom started doing circles right in front of us, quacking and actually wagging her tail.
Mild-mannered Joel Armstrong, duck hero. We've got pictures of the great duck rescue at NPR.org.
Half of the demented things I've ever done, I blame on summer camp. Camp Indianola in Madison, Wisconsin, in my case. Summer camps are often places of sweaty cabins with appropriated Indian names, counselors of college age who'd probably rather be hitchhiking across Europe, color wars, camp shows and songs, short-sheeting beds, and other pranks more painful. I'm remembering you here, Jackie Gerstein. Roger Bennett has documented some of the details of summer camp for boys and girls in his book Camp Camp, Where Fantasy Island Meets Lord of the Flies. Roger Bennett joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
And as I understand it, you spent 3 years collecting essays, more than 80,000 photos from camp life in the 80s and 90s. My gosh, why is camp so interesting to you?
There's probably no better prism to really look at our generation, who we are and how we got to be that way, other than through the summer camp prism. So the book is about summer camp, but it is in kind of the same way as Plato's cave is about prisoners in chains. We're really trying to glimpse the journey of our generation and who we are.
One of the things several of the essays in the book talk about is the fact that in many camps, there really is a severe social order. You've got a phrase written here where you say the cabin could be a place of mental torture in which techniques befitting the CIA's PSYOPs manual were commonplace.
Yeah, well, we documented in the boys' bunk where the physical violence was definitely extremely present as opposed to the girls' bunk where I think things were a lot more mentally tortuous. We did able to collect over 20 remarkable pieces of violence that were everyday occurrences within the boys' bunk. And the thing that was fascinating about collecting them is that when the people told us about them, they actually loved being on the receiving end because, as one of them said, if you were given a bungee cord wedgie, it meant the counselors noticed you. It meant that you had arrived.
There's a man who actually is on our show a good deal named A.J. Jacobs, who's an editor, of course, at Esquire magazine. And he has an essay in here, which I think will make a lot of people twinge. It's called Dear Scott Blunken. Scott Blunken is a young man who A.J. bullied. A.J. writes, I'm sorry we mocked your tick, where you puckered your lips every 30 seconds. I'm sorry we bet you 5 Kit Kat bars you couldn't go a whole day without puckering your lips. I'm sorry we spent the rest of the day puckering our own lips and saying, ooh, that feels so good. It's so good to pucker the lips. It goes on and on. He emotionally bullied this young man.
He did, and he wasn't alone. And the other part of AJ's essay that puts it into context is that he reveals that he was the victim of bullies in his own school. So this was a group of individuals who'd been bullied coming together to beat up on a kid. But the second point is, at the end of the essay, he reveals that he would never, as a result of this experience, send his own kid to summer camp. So it stayed with him.
Did you have a camp?
I did have a camp. I grew up in Liverpool, England, which was a remarkable place to come of age. And I grew up on a steady diet of Starsky and Hutch, Fantasy Island, Heart to Heart. But I came over when I was 19, expecting to hang out with Huggy Bear in New York City, but being whisked off to Maine, to a wonderful camp, as it turns out, before I knew what hit me. And I'd never seen anything like it. The subtitle of the book is Fantasy Island Meets Lord of the Flies. It truly was a teenage utopia where it seemed to me kids were making the rules for other kids. And there were firsts just occurring all over the place. Kids were learning to shoot the basketball for the first time, to swim the breaststroke, to take the lead in a version of Guys and Dolls. And obviously at night, when it got dark and everyone cloaked themselves in Drakkar or High Karate Aftershave or Charlie or CK, it became a very different place, a sexual petri dish where a whole load of other kinds of firsts were going down. I just found the whole place unbelievable.
Let me quote an essay here from Jamie Denbo. I guess she was at Camp Tel Noir in Hampstead, New Hampshire.
Indeed.
So many men, so little time, she writes. This is the sentiment that would go through my head as I applied one last layer of Revlon's pink foil lipstick, or gave my deeply sun and damaged locks one more spritz of Aquanet. The social, that twice monthly event that brought boys and girls together, literally together, her iron grip clamped down on his shoulders, his sweaty fingers. Can I finish this sentence? Delicately lying over her hips. I can't believe any parent listening to our conversation is going to let their son or daughter go to summer camp after the way you've just described it.
I would bet the opposite. I bet that there's parents all over the country listening to this, wishing that they could leave their jobs and return to that time and place. And
the parents could do it now that you've got some wisdom.
Well, that was one of the more remarkable parts of doing the book, is that we reunited former bunks, which was not too hard because so many of them are in deep, deep contact still. Listening to them, we realize there's a nation of Americans who on the surface have been able to sculpt seemingly normal lives as lawyers, doctors, accountants and the like, but they're still waiting for the color war cannon to go off at any second, and they'd love to depart from their current reality and go back to that time and place where it felt like anything was possible.
Mr. Bennett, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
Roger Bennett is the co-creator of the book Camp Camp, where Fantasy Island meets Lord of the Flies. To see photos and stories from the book, you can come to our website, npr.org, and you can see our NPR Summer Camp Flickr group, where you'll find, in fact, my camp photo, along with my mother on Parents' Day, as well as those of other NPR staffers. While you're there, you can upload your own timeless camp photos. This is Weekend Edition, directed by Elaine Heinzman, produced by Sarah Byer-Kelly, Bridget McCarthy, Darcy Bacon, Justine Kennan, Janaea Williams, MJ Davis, Elliot Hannon, Jenny Gold, and Victoria Chow. Our technical director is the old red wasp, Burke Hun, so ably assisted by Lamar Nickens, Kevin Maynor, and Kurt Stalnicker, our librarians, Kim Oleski and Mary Glendening, our senior editor, Tony Marcano. Peter Breslow's away on vacation. I'm the former editor of the Camp Indianola Totem Pole.
This is David Honeyboy Edwards, an original master of Mississippi Delta Blues. This recording by Alan Lomax, the great music collector, is in the Library of Congress. Honeyboy Edwards plays his guitar in an old schoolhouse, Clarksburg, Mississippi, 1942.
So many days since you went away, how much I'm gonna worry. Both night and day. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry my life anymore.
This is Honeyboy Edwards today in NPR studio, 93 years old and still touring.
Going out, baby, no. Going down slow, got a mind of gamma cane, wet no more, but that's all right. I know you love me, girl, but that's all right. But every night and I'm running on, don't do loving.
Honey Boy Edwards is a history book of the blues. He's played with Howlin' Wolf, John Lee Hooker, Charlie Patton, Muddy Waters. He was with the legendary Robert Johnson on the day Johnson was poisoned. That story in a minute. Honey Boy Edwards' long career started in the crucible of American blues, the Deep South, during Jim Crow.
My father was a sharecropper. And at night when they'd come out to the field, they'd get in the cotton sacks and chairs and play the blues, shuffle blues, low down, dirty, shame blues, and drink whiskey and get drunk all night.
As a child, Edwards learned to play listening. Workers picked cotton all day and played the blues all night. Later on, Honey Boy figured out he could make more money playing music on the weekend than he could working in the fields all week. But at that time, if a black man was caught not working during the day, he'd be thrown in jail as a vagrant. So Edwards did what he had to do. He stayed inside.
I didn't come out till 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. That's when everybody come out the field. They don't know whether I've been in the field or not.
What'd you do all day?
Sleep all day. Sleep and cook and eat, stay in the house. I ain't out there. Sun is hot anyway. I ain't not out there.
You are a smart man.
Baby, your trouble gonna come someday. Your trouble gonna come someday. Just go ahead on, baby. Go ahead on, baby. Nah, nah. You can have your way.
I wish people could see you play because you move, they shake the guitar while you're playing.
I got to do that to make it sound. I got to do something.
I read that you played with Robert Johnson.
Yeah, I did in 1937, 38. In and out, me and him and Tommy McLennan played in and out together until August. In 38, he died in August. In 38, he got poisoned.
The night Robert Johnson was poisoned, Honey Boy Edwards showed up at a house party Johnson was playing in Three Forks, Mississippi.
When we got there, Robert was sitting in the corner with his guitar like I'm holding my guitar now.
On your lap?
Yeah, and he had been playing a little. Bit. Robert was crazy about two things, whiskey and women. He's crazy about whiskey and women. And what happened, he had been playing for this man out of the Three Fork, and the man had a good-looking wife.
Honey Boy says the jealous husband gave his wife a bottle of corn whiskey to give to Robert Johnson. The whiskey was poisoned.
The poison that he put in that whiskey killed him, slow killed him, you know? Mm. He had a slow death. Robert had drank about a little bit of half of the whiskey, better than half pint. Started getting sick. People come in. Play the blues, Robert, play the blues. Play the tab plant blues. Play this, play this. He said, I don't feel too good. And the people thought maybe because he loved that whiskey, he wanted another drink or something like that. He said, come on, get this another drink. Come on, you'll be all right then. After found out he really was sick, 1938, 16th of August, I was 23 years old. Yeah, but I've been playing blues a long time.
You still playing in bars?
Oh, yeah.
You like that?
It's all right, having fun, drinking, talking to the young women, running around, having fun.
Things haven't changed much, huh?
No, I can do anything I ever done, just take more time.
Woo! How am I supposed to respond to that?
Yeah. I'm standing on the corner, drunk as I can be. Some woman said, you the one for me, you the one, you the one. You is the only one, baby, Nana, you is the one for me.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
Do your fingers feel different now?
My fingers just as good as it was when I was 20, so far.
So far at 93.
So far.
David Honeyboy Edwards. Head to npr.org to hear more of his in-studio performance with harmonica player Michael Frank.
Well, Lord, you be give me satisfied. Be blue, na na na. Time and out is fine. You the one. You the one, you the one. Yeah, the only one, damn na na.
The devotions of Chicago Cub fans to their team is legendary, historic, and often a little weird. Boy, do I know. But what do we do with those devotions in our afterlives? Dennis Mascari has an idea. He's the founder of Fans Forever Incorporated, which is developing a cemetery plot that will resemble the famous ivy-covered confines of Wrigley Field. Mr. Mascari joins us from the studios of member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us.
That's my pleasure.
So, ivy-covered brick walls?
An ivy-covered brick wall. We're going to have the scoreboard over the wall done in all stained glass.
a score on it for the ages?
If there is a score on it, the Cubs will be winning.
Do you call these eternal skyboxes?
Yeah. In some of the articles, it appears that I'm trying to build like an atmosphere of Wrigley Field with the bleacher bums and things like this, but we want to keep the wall as dignified as possible for the families.
Mm. So, in other words, you won't be selling beer and hot dogs there?
Well, we might have pizza.
Those little Ron Santo pizzas?
Absolutely. Remember those?
Of course I remember those.
Yeah.
A squalid question. Is this going to cost substantially more than, how shall I put it, traditional internment?
No, a lot less. I'm not doing this to take advantage of the Cubs' popularity. My dad used to take me out to Wrigley Field when I was 5 years old. It's a family tradition.
And Wrigley Field means something to people.
It's a cathedral. I've been in buildings like, you know, the Eiffel Tower, the Vatican, the pyramids. But when I walk into Wrigley Field, it's the happiest place on earth to me.
Yeah, Mr. Mascari, I got to tell you, I thought I was a bad Cub fan.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely hooked. When you walk into Wrigley Field, there's a special feeling that you get that I can't get anywhere else.
Perhaps when families come to visit their loved ones there, you're hoping a little bit of that feeling.
Well, that's the whole important thing. I lost my dad about a year and a half ago, and he's in an outside mausoleum. And I walk in there, and it's a cold feeling. When you come to Beyond the Vines, that's the name of my project, when you come there to visit your loved one, you're going to feel like you're back at the ballpark. You're going to know inside, wow, my husband or my father or my grandfather really would love knowing that he's in a place like this.
Good response so far?
Oh, I can't believe it. There's been some great comments and some not-so-great comments. Mostly the not-so-great comments are coming from the White Sox fans. They're kind of happy, and they said, I hope your business booms. Yeah, the more the merrier. Yeah, it's a rough group. This morning I got a beautiful email from a lady who told me my dad passed away last year, and please hold me a space because I know that my dad would just love being here. Cub fans don't live forever, but their spirit never dies. I'm just trying to give them a perpetual box seat.
We've restrained ourselves thus far, but I can't hold it back anymore.
Let me guess.
They still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls.
The late Steve Goodman and Mr. Mascari, nice talking to you.
You too.
To the home of the brave, the land of the free and the doormat of the National League.
NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters is filled with people privileged to travel around the world to bring back stories about remarkable persons. For the past 4 years, one of the most remarkable was sitting right downstairs. Gary Smith was a big, friendly man with a joshing smile who presided over the front desk. With undiscriminating warmth, he welcomed employees and visitors, executives and tourists, delivery people, and those who'd just wander in to use a bathroom. Gary Smith died this week at the age of 57. He loved his family, his friends, his faith, his work, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. That order was reversed during the football season. Gary managed to have personal relationships, friendships, with hundreds of people at the same time and regarded his friendships as living things to be nourished every day. He remembered birthdays, hometowns, and the names of your children. He asked about spouses, mothers, and where you got those shoes. He told you what he thought about those shoes. Once I brought our daughter's deceased fish, Salmon Fishty, into work in a plastic bag. I was going to get a new fish, switch salmons, if you please, on the way home. Told Gary I had to put the late Sammy in a bin. Gary said, "You can't do that, Scott. That little fish has a soul. Everyone has a soul. We have to bury him." So we went outside together, scooped out a small hole, and consigned Salmon Fishty to eternal rest under a city tree. When I was flummoxed about what to say, Gary spoke up. "Sammy, you were a great little fish, and little girl loved you. Thank you." It was as perfect an oration about a life as I've ever heard. NPR's White House correspondent David Green is also a Steelers fan. After David's mother died, Gary would call him on Sundays because he knew David missed talking to his mother during the games. When the Steelers were welcomed to the White House after winning the Super Bowl, David made certain Gary got a credential. The two of them gawked and squealed, but Gary made sure to get David an autograph from his mother's favorite player. "Here's a man who asked for so little," David said this week, "and yet was willing to spread love to strangers who walked through those glass doors." Gary was religious, in a building filled with people, in a profession that's known for attracting skeptics. Yet I heard a few reporters say yesterday, if a person as good as Gary was religious, maybe there's something to God. I think that something was reflected in the way Gary reminded us, everyone has a soul. People would walk through those glass doors, hurried, harried, anxious, timorous, angry, or distressed. Gary beheld them with a kind of rare insight at which journalists can only marvel. Gary Smith saw through to people's souls, and the beauty that Gary was determined to see in others was the loveliness that lit up his face and so many lives every day. Let's win one for Gary. This is NPR News. Every year, more than 500 million people contract malaria. More than 3 million of them die. The situation is especially dire in sub-Saharan Africa. In Uganda alone, nearly 320 people die of the disease every day. Reporter Stephanie Jackenthal has the unusual story of an American kayaker who's helping to fight malaria in Uganda by running a sort of kayaking camp with the cause.
In January of 2003, I was invited on a kayak expedition back to the Zambezi, where I had once worked as a whitewater rafting guide, and then to the Nile, where I'd never been before. And while I was here, two of the guys who were part of our group got malaria, and I had to treat them.
Good thing for them that Jessie Stone is also a doctor. 5 years ago, she had temporarily given up medicine and left New York to pursue her passion for kayaking. She had no idea that her medical career and her passion would cross paths and change her life, and literally save lives in rural Uganda.
Okay, good. The net looks nice. Can we see the other one that's hanging?
Daddy, look.
Big, big hole. We have to explain to her that now it becomes a mosquito trap instead of a mosquito net. Mosquitoes fly in and they can't get out.
This is just one of a dozen hut calls Dr. Stone is making this day. She's educating Ugandans about malaria prevention while inspecting mosquito nets hung in their dank, mud and dung homes. It's a mission she started soon after her kayaking friends contracted the disease.
And then that made me look around at the larger problem of malaria here and ask the simple question, do people have mosquito nets? Do they get malaria all the time? What do they do?
Very little, it turned out. Dr. Stone said a survey she and an assistant conducted in a village called Kibera found that no one had a mosquito net, and most didn't understand how malaria is spread. As a result, the village was physically debilitated and economically devastated.
There was this cycle that was going on every single month where people were spending all of their income on malaria, and it was so easy to prevent it and certainly to reduce substantially the number of illnesses that people had and to prevent death.
Since then, Dr. Jessie, as she's known here, has built Soft Power Health in Bujagali, and her volunteers have spread out across eastern Uganda, holding education sessions under mango trees, schoolyards, or village squares. They use 7 hand-drawn cartoons on oak tag to illustrate malaria's progression.
Mrs. Anopheles, the female mosquito, bites you at nighttime, usually when you're sleeping, and it's during that time that she transfers the malaria into your body. And it's Mrs. Anopheles who's biting you because she needs to make a meal of your blood to feed her eggs. Mr. Anopheles only eats fruits and plants.
Every day, crews of volunteers, interpreters, and educators based near the Nile drive up to 3 hours across washed-out red clay roads to the surrounding 30 villages, educating groups of 30 to 300 people at a time. Dr. Stone supplements the lessons with mosquito nets. She sells at a subsidized rate of 3,000 shillings each, or about $1.50 U.S. currency. That's a day's pay in this part of Uganda. In the past 4 years, her organization has educated more than 100,000 people and sold more than 25,000 nets.
What we've discovered is that if people have to pay a little something for their mosquito net, they are invested in that net. We've seen with nets that have been given away in some of the villages that we work in, that those nets that have been given away free are not used and are often just resold for money.
2 to 6 months later, they make follow-up visits in villages.
How many people, including children, sleep under the net? We're out there and with translators and local educators trying to make sure that the correct information gets to people. I really think that that's the only way forward for prevention of malaria. It's not going to be through some fancy means of getting the material out there. It's just going to be through simple, hard work like this.
She's saying that now the money she used to take to the hospital, she can now buy milk for her baby.
Okay.
Dr. Stone hopes to expand the malaria program and establish clinics in other rural villages in Uganda. As for her other passion,
I am also here to kayak as much as I can to train for upcoming events and expeditions. So it's a balance of those two things.
For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Jackenthal.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.